I want our gathering this morning to have, once again, as much as we can, a parabolic shape. Not the perfect curve, but the shape of a parable. We're embodied souls, and that's one of the themes that I feel like as a pastor and as a Christian, as a thoughtful Christian, that I seem to have been given to broadcast in the world. The reminder that it doesn't help us to disassociate our souls from our bodies, that we need to recover a linkage, that the history of Christianity and modernity in some unique ways has really kind of hived those things off from one another so they have nothing to do with one another. And they need to have everything to do with one another. And that's one of the reasons why when we gather, we would bother with things like the symbols that we do. That's why the band isn't in the center of our physical space. Very deliberate thing. That's why I keep kind of banging my broken drum about the theater part of the story, the actor part of the story. Because we're trying to bring together the things that have been separated. We're trying to reintegrate what we believe and how we act in embodied ways, not just ideological ways. And the parables do this uniquely in the biblical record. And so what I want us to do with the shape of the next part of our gathering is to engage with what we're wrestling with as ideas, but I also want us to engage in ways that are more than just listening, ways that can help us learn to not just act out our explorations or our questions, but also to act out the things that we feel like we find or we learn or we grow into, things where we kind of go, I need to do something with this. And so in a lot of ways, we shape a gathering like this the way that we do as practice, as rehearsal, if you want. Little ways of, with our bodies, in space and time, start to actually practice the kind of learning that we need to do if we're actually going to change the way we live as people in the world. We've got to rehearse it. It doesn't come easy. It's like anything we learn with our bodies, right? Practice helps. So we're practicing. And all that to say that the parables, when Jesus used parables, what he was doing was he was sitting one thing alongside another to make a point. He was setting things side by side on purpose to provoke, to stir us up. And it's not that unusual that when Jesus shared a parable, the people that he shared it with weren't exactly comforted by the parable. In fact, it wasn't that unusual for people to leave an encounter with the parable so pissed that they were ready to just kill the storyteller. And my purpose this morning is not to make anyone angry, and particularly, selfishly, not to make anyone angry enough that they wish to kill the storyteller. But my mission this morning does not include helping us feel more comfortable either. It just deliberately doesn't this morning, for good or for ill. I don't want to re-victimize anyone in how I do my part of this gathering, and that's one possible thing that could happen, so you should be advised about that. But there are some things that we need to engage this morning that we shouldn't engage and feel at ease about. They're not those kind of things. I'm not trying to dictate distress in saying this, okay? I'm not trying to tell anybody how to feel. But I am of a substantial conviction that what we're going to wrestle with together this morning is not the sort of thing that we get to be blasé about. And if we are, it might be quite simply this isn't our time to carry this. That's legitimate. But I think not being willing to test that, not being willing to ask the question, what do I need to carry out of this? That even if it's distressing to me, I think not asking the question, not being willing to even toy with engaging, is to be irresponsible. If that comes off as judgmental, again, I apologize because that's not my intent. I saw a very inspiring bumper sticker this week. I wrote it down in my journal. It was simple, but I'm starting to forget simple things some days. The bumper sticker was black with white text. It said, unjudgment day is coming. That's not a bad vision for the world, eh?
All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a little bit what Jesus did. We're going to set two things side by side this morning, and we're going to do that in order to get ourselves to think and to engage. We're going to begin with a story that's a contemporary one, and so because it's contemporary, it comes to us via YouTube. We're going to watch it. We're going to watch this piece, which some of you might have seen or be aware of. We're going to watch it in its entirety, even though it's about 9 minutes long, which in our world is a long time. We're going to watch it in its entirety partly because the pace of it is part of the message of it. The way that this is offered to us, I think, represents some issues in our culture with a particular clarity and a poignancy, and I think we need to be as unflinching as we can in acknowledging the shape of the world in which we live and in which we do this exploration of matters of belief and spirituality. And in particular, I think it's important for us to begin to ask the question whether what we say we believe or what we consider when we're trying to understand what it might mean to be a Christ follower, we need to be willing to wrestle pretty directly with whether that actually has anything to do with current affairs or not, or whether what we believe is a purely private matter. Some segments of our culture would affirm that belief is such a private matter so vigorously that we get almost comedic moments in the culture, like we had this past week with CBC's knee-jerk reaction to the incoming chief of police suggestion that we should pray for our neighbors. I don't know how many of you caught that. But I'm a CBC fan, and I was driving around laughing because I was just like, people, you are blowing the credibility of your journalism right out the side door with your response to this. Anyway, they have had to kind of come around. It's been a fascinating story to watch. We'll come back to it later. But that is the other side of this coin. That's what happens when we take the privatization of belief to an extreme. We get those kind of reactions to the simple suggestion that in any faith, in any practice, if you're thinking about your neighbor as prayer, you're a lot less likely, in the words of the incoming chief of police, to shoot them. What we believe has something to do with how we live in the culture. This comes to us very much from this time in our culture. A month after Amanda posted that, a couple of weeks ago, she committed suicide. She's dead. So that's one story. And the second story, which we want to set alongside this one, is an ancient one. And so we have to read it and make the pictures for ourselves.
On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? He replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? In reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road. When he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So to a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was. And when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, And when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expenses you may have. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, go and do likewise.
It's interesting, you know, the profile of these stories is intriguing to me. The Amanda Todd story, of course, has all kinds of profile in our culture at the moment. The other story, which most of us recognize, at least in its outline, if not in its detail, is essentially about the same thing. And its cultural profile has grown considerably since it was told, to the point where, even though we live in a post-Christian culture, our law contains something called the Good Samaritan Act. So it's come to actually represent something in our cultural milieu that has quite a bit of sway. These stories have a fair bit in common, and I want to characterize them in a way that I don't mean to trivialize either story, but it's memorable for me. I'm going to say that these are both what I would call, at least this morning, Mexican chili dip stories. We had a whole bunch of adolescents in our house last night, along with their families, something we do once in a while. And anytime that happens in our household, we make Mexican chili dip. And I'm not going to trouble you with all the details of it, because that combined with the fact that it's a potluck and we can all smell that would just be way too distracting. What I'm going to tell you is that it has layers, any one of which is worth consuming, but when you put them all together and you heat the whole thing up and you work your way down through it, it's awesome. These stories are kind of like that. They have layers, and they have some layers in common. And I think it's important for us to kind of name that as a way of recognizing what they have to say to one another. So we'll start with story one, with Amanda Todd's story. The first layer of that story, I think we could say, is the layer of tragedy, the layer of loss. It immediately presents itself to us. This didn't have to happen. This ought not to happen. This is tragic. And so we look at the events and we say that's wrong and it's preventable, or at least it should be, and we mourn and we grieve. And I think that layer is followed, and this is not unusual in a journey that has to do with suffering or with grief, I think that layer is followed fairly naturally with blame, with the question, who's responsible? I think sometimes when we're suffering, that's a self-serving question. Who's responsible for my suffering? Understandable, but that's its scope. But it's one of those kind of questions that can grow into a lot bigger question about who's responsible for a wider problem. And I think that's part of what has happened with Amanda Todd's story in our culture. The layer under that is the layer of what has to be done so that this problem, so that this tragedy, either in a particular way or in some broader representative way, doesn't happen again. And we're just kind of working our way down through the problem, right? We could also frame that question as being the question, what is the way to a better world? Same question. One of them is particular to the events, and the other one kind of broadens it. We could think about it that way. We could think about that question by asking, what must be done? Sort of the action question. What must be done to save a world or people or particular persons from this kind of thing that's destructive? I find it super interesting how these discussions, even when they're offered in a post-Christian culture like ours, come around so quickly to questions that we might say are questions about salvation or redemption. And I don't mean to use those words in a religious or Christian manner right at the moment, even though we often do and we certainly can. I mean in the shared human sense of those questions come around to something that says, this is not right. This is not right. And we know it needs to change. Now what? That's a question about redeeming something, about saving something. It was interesting. I kind of felt like I knew where I wanted to go with this a couple of weeks ago. And then, having made that decision, I stopped to get the mail on the way home, and the October 29th issue of Maclean's magazine had this for its cover. The Real World of Bullying. They picked up the story and made it their focus. It's in the society section of Maclean's. See, this is where we ask these questions, right? We live here. We live here. Amanda lived here. Amanda died here. Amanda posted that video on YouTube. Some of us live there. This is our society. The lead story in this issue is from a relatively young female journalist named Emma Tayatel. And I'm going to read you the front end of it. This is really interesting. The Canadian public is mourning the loss of Amanda Todd, a 15-year-old teenager from Port Coquitlam, BC, whose social media tormentors dared her to take her own life and rejoiced in cyberspace when she eventually did. Todd died last Wednesday, 1 month after she posted a heartbreaking 8-minute YouTube confessional about the events that drove her into a severe depression. Over 100 Facebook walls have been erected in Todd's memory since her death, and some anti-bullying activists have called for Pink Shirt Day, a national anti-bullying initiative to honor Todd's memory. NDP MP Danny Morin introduced a motion in the House of Commons that proposed increased funding for anti-bullying organizations, as well as an in-depth studying of bullying in Canada. This is all great news. It confirms we're a well-meaning country. We take care of our own, albeit too late in this case. But it also confirms that Amanda Todd is now an official martyr of the anti-bullying movement, a movement bent on proving that bullying is a social construct, and that perhaps if we all love each other a little more and hug each other a little longer, it will one day disappear. I'm of the belief that bullying will always exist because so will bullying's parents, discord and cruelty. But I'm equally uncomfortable with the increasingly common assertion that bullying is a rite of passage, that kids will be kids and bullies will be bullies. After all, just because something exists doesn't mean that we can't limit its presence. The question is, how do we go about doing that? Unlike Mark Stein and anyone else with a crippling fear of political correctness, I don't think Pink Shirt Day is a scourge, but I do think it's largely ineffective. Why? Because nobody can see your anti-bullying t-shirt on the internet where Amanda Todd was arguably bullied to death. That is interesting.
The article that follows that one in this issue has the subtitle, "Can BC Teen's Tragic Story Help Foster Needed Change?" And that story, which I'm not going to read you any of, but which is worth reading, ends with the writer concluding that even though, you know, the hacktivists Anonymous outed some 32-year-old guy as the perpetrator of this crime, and even though there's this ongoing investigation and so on and so forth, this writer says, if they're correct, this alleged perpetrator's capture came too late for Amanda Todd, but in the end it may not have mattered. As she wrote on one of those pages, "What's left of me now? Nothing stops." And then, in a layout tweak that got my attention, immediately under those words, is a small sidebar featuring Miss Universe Canada 2012 talking in the online version of Maclean's about how she was bullied growing up in Richmond, BC, and how she managed to overcome it. Her picture's in color.
which I think carries us into our other story, which poses some of the same questions, although the setting is one of religious debate, and so the order of the questions is inverted. The questioner in the Good Samaritan story is a member of the educated elite, which, not coincidentally, I think probably defines most of us in this room, in any global context. Some translators would call him a lawyer in the translation, which is a little bit misleading, because although he was an expert in the law, which is how we would name a lawyer in our culture, the law in which he was an expert was the religious law. So we could just as well name him a bit of a theologian as we could a bit of a lawyer. It starts, this story, with what in our relatively irreligious culture is often the last question which we come to in these kind of conversations. It starts with the bottom of the chili dip. It starts with the question, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Which is another way, as lots of questioners put it to Jesus in the biblical record, what must I do to be saved? What must I do to be redeemed? That's the cultural question, made personal and set into a religious context. Okay? So that's kind of where we start. We could say that this thoughtful, intelligent person is asking the question, how can I solve this problem forever? And Jesus responds by turning the question back to the questioner, which is a super important lesson in itself. We could just stop right there and learn something really, really important, not just as a teaching method. Jesus kind of does that Socratic thing, you know, we're going to ask a question until you figure out the answer. But aside from a teaching method, what's important is that when Jesus makes that choice in this story, I think one of the things that it needs to say to us is, this is our business. This is what we're here to do. This is Jesus' perspective on how this works. When this educated person comes to Jesus with this real conundrum of a question and hands it to Jesus and says, Jesus, give me the answer to this question. Jesus just hands it right back and says, you give me the answer to this question. That's what you're here to do. Now do it. This is our work. So we get to do it. I think it's super important that Jesus handles this that way. And the answer that this lawyer gives is one of the most commonly shared values among world religions. The answer that the lawyer gives to Jesus about how do I get eternal life is, well, I need to obey the golden rule. I need to treat others as I would have them treat me. And that sums up the law and the prophets, right? So that ought to cover it. Super common value. Any values-based thinking and belief system pretty much has some version of this in it. And that's fantastic, right? That's a fantastic summation of the answer to the question, what must I do to be saved? So now we're all done, right? You would think it's global enough that it should capture it. Let's be nice to one another, and whatever the problem is that has to do with discord and cruelty and so on, it's going to go away. The first article that I read, the writer gets that, right? She's on about exactly that. She goes on to say in that article that although she doesn't think that's enough, but she also goes on to say that she doesn't think we should let the matter rest. I came of age on the internet. Like 43% of kids today, I was a victim of cyberbullying, though I didn't really think of it as such because the term hadn't been invented yet. I was also undoubtedly a cyberbully. My parents, God bless them, had no idea what I was doing on MSN Messenger and ICQ, which is a precursor to Facebook and Formspring. When I was 11, I saw middle-aged men masturbating on webcam. I saw a video of two raccoons mauling each other to death. I saw two boys from my homeroom class strip for me in an online chat room. And I returned the favor. In fact, this was a weekly afternoon ritual for my girlfriends and me. My mom and dad were upstairs watching Frasier. We would be in the basement, quote, exploring the internet. She goes on to say, what's alarming about this story in some ways is not what Amanda Todd did, but that it's common. That she didn't do anything that much of her generation has done. When this writer says that she doesn't think be nice to one another and hug one another a little more is enough, She is saying, essentially, the same thing that Jesus is saying. Jesus also doesn't think that that is enough. And provoked by this expert in the law, who seems to really wish, like I think most of us do, to be absolved of responsibility for the problems that are generated by some riffraff from the wrong side of town who walked down a bad street alone when everybody knows you shouldn't do that and got the crap beat out of them. And isn't this their problem anyway? You see, this is the same logic that drives this, right? The story of Amanda Todd is not a simplistic story. Was Amanda a participant in that story? Absolutely, she was a participant. First, she's a participant as a lured child. And then she's a participant as somebody who longs so much to be accepted, so much to be loved, that when some older guy comes along and says, "I think you're beautiful, my girlfriend's out of town, let's hook up," she falls for it. And she gets it now. Right? She gets that that was a terrible mistake. She says as much. But what? What's her explanation? "But I thought you really liked me." God have mercy. So, hug one another a little more and be nice to one another. It doesn't cover that off. The McLean's writer gets it, Jesus gets it. The lawyer wants off the hook, and Jesus says, it's not that simple. And then he gives us the Good Samaritan story. Now, the Good Samaritan story is set up by the same dilemma. There's an out. Okay? The out is that the guy shouldn't have been on that street, on that road to Jericho. He shouldn't have been there by himself. He made an error in judgment. Amanda wouldn't have gotten into this whole mess if she just hadn't flashed the webcam in the first place. Why'd she do that? She chose that, right? Nobody else was there. Nobody assaulted her and made her do that. She just chose it. So she's complicit. And even if she kind of was too young to know better, she kind of learned better right away when the whole thing coincided as the first time. So how come she kept making all these subsequent mistakes? And if she made all these subsequent mistakes, and the people around her were a bunch of riffraff and idiots too, why is it my deal to wade into that shit and get involved? That's their deal, not my deal. We all have this story playing, right, in us, around us. Jesus just won't let the matter rest. And so he works his way down through the layers. And one way to characterize the layers that he works through in this story is to say right away in the story of the Good Samaritan, we come to the idea that religious ideas won't cut it. That stated beliefs actually don't address this very well. Being thought of as a culturally good or a rule-keeping person also won't cut it, because those are the exact people that walk by. Thinking about what needs to be done, peeking at the problem, walking over to have a look at the victim, finding it distressing, walking away, also won't do it. So we could pretty easily do that this morning, right? We just kind of wandered over and had a little peek at Amanda's distress, and it did trouble us, I expect, and that's appropriate as far as it goes. If it only goes that far, Jesus says in this story, not enough. That's actually not what salvation looks like. It's not what a better world looks like. And so in the end, Jesus brings us to the question of what must be done and who must do it, and it comes down to this. What must be done, in fact, is that we would, in fact, treat others as we wish to be treated. The kicker is that we need to do that despite all the reasons that it is unreasonable to do so. That we need to do that in a way that actually reaches across the typical divides, the lines of race, the lines of prejudice, the evidence to the contrary, the evidence that says, this is not my problem. One of the people that was in our home last night, dad who drove his daughter out to this gathering, is a physician in the city. He's the director, I don't know if I'll get his title right, he's the director of tropical medicine in our region. Fairly high profile physician, guy who's very involved in relief work, particularly in Haiti, and could school out a lot of stories about this. We ended up having a fascinating conversation last night about the initial context was this police, the incoming police chief and his pray for your neighbor thing, and how that had blown up. Pierre had also been kind of, this doctor had also been kind of laughing at the news response. So we had that in common. And
And but he said, you know what? He said, I feel really hopeful because this might be a guy who, when I get his ear, I might be able to help him understand why harm reduction is actually a working strategy for dealing with the problem of drug abuse, unlike the war on drugs. But we're just not going to get into that whole topic today. This was the framework for our conversation, okay? And as we kind of went along in that conversation, he said, you know, when I'm trying to help people with faith understand the way harm reduction would work in caring for addicts, I use the story of the Good Samaritan. The guy in the gutter in the Good Samaritan story is the guy in the East Hastings, the guy in the North End, the guy that's a block from here right now, face down. And he's on a vomit, and when he wakes up, he's going to go back to using injectable drugs, and if he can't get clean water to do it, he's going to use puddle water if he can find any of his thought. So I got a couple of choices. If I'm involved with this guy, I can walk up to him and kind of look at him lying there in the result of his own choices, and I can kind of give him a kick in the head and walk away. And we just, man, you're an idiot. And whatever you get, either you got it coming or there's really nothing that can be done. So either way, this isn't my problem. Or I've got a solution. I'm going to lock you up because you're a hazard. That's going to keep you away from drugs. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to get you out of harm's way. Right. Side B, harm reduction side. Now, I'm taking this very sketchily, I realize. For those of you that are aware of the complexity of these issues, please forget that. The other side could say, you're a person. How you came to be here is way more complex than the first blush of this story would tell. Were you complicit, duplicit? Were you a participant? Of course you were a participant. Is that the whole story? Not even close. And even if it was true, what Jesus is saying in this story is that what it means to actually walk into the mess in a way that makes a difference in the mess means acknowledging the truth of those limitations and walking in anyway. Why? Why? There's no sufficient, simple argument to answer that question in those circumstances unless we understand that person to have a kind of value that is not grounded in their choice. Unless we understand that person to have a value that is external to them and given to them that they carry by virtue of being human. See, the Christian understanding of what it means to be a human being is that you are made by God. Full stop. And when you come into the world, you come in with all of that value. And there's nothing that you can do, there's nothing that I can do that strips us of that value. That's impossible from the vantage point of our Maker. But there are all sorts of things that we can do that assail that value in the world. There are all sorts of things that we can do that affirm that value. But we can't do it if we use the logic that a lot of the people in this contemporary story around Mandatar are using, and that a lot of folks in the war on drugs are using, and that the lawyer uses. This is not my problem. Why? Because the person in the gutter is an idiot that made bad choices. No, this is my problem. Why? Because I'm a human. Because they're a human. Because we bear the same imprint. Now, I get the idea of wading into what's messy as this fraught with problems. I get it in my home. I get it in my life. I get it when I wonder if the addicts that I love should be trusted with my children. I know this isn't simple, but we don't have a lot of time together in a given morning, and I need to draw some thick lines once in a while so we go away thinking about the big questions. If we actually think about them, if we actually engage with them, this is what the incoming chief of police is arguing, by the way, essentially. If we actually engage with them, we live them differently. Not because we've answered them, but because we're wrestling with them. If you're praying for your neighbor, you're less likely to shoot them. You're more likely to think about how you might do some good for them. Good argument. Good human argument. Even if you strip it of all its religious implications. Maybe especially if you strip it of all its religious implications.
When Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, he is so egregious in his choice of illustration that it's just unmissable. We can take the fortune cookie version of it. We can take the be nice to one another, hug a little more, and it'll all be a better world. We can take it at that level and we can carry on. And that might be better than where we were. And I don't want to make light of that. But it's not what Jesus is on about. When he chooses who is lying by the side of the road, and he chooses who helps who's lying by the side of the road, it's like he walks into a southern U.S. fundamentalist convention on why gays should be killed. And he tells a story that says, you know what? The preacher who was up right before me, that's the guy in the gutter. And guess who stops to help him? Right, the gay guy. He walks into New York City. He walks into the center of the city where the monuments and the towers are. And he says, guess who the helper is? That's right. It's a terrorist. Boo! You didn't see that coming, did you? You see why people were so pissed when he told these stories? It's like, whoa! And what he's trying to say is it's this big. The thing that I'm calling you to, the thing that I'm asking, the thing that this story's about, it happens at this level. Why do we need God in this story? Why can't we just kind of hug one another a little more, be nice to one another, and have it come around? Because for this story to work the way that Jesus is talking about actually requires something inside of us that is way bigger than our logic, that is way bigger than our rationale for these situations, that has way more power than we can summon just by grabbing ourselves by our social bootstraps and pulling a little harder.
That's good, Tim.
It's not going to happen, people. And the guy who wrote the claims knows that it's not going to happen. And that's the way he ends, the way Manitoba ends. Nothing's going to change. This is serious. Right? We live here. We act here. If we're parents, we raise our kids here. The writer of the first article goes on, intriguingly, to basically say, I don't think hugging one another a little more is going to do it, but something has to be done. And she goes on to say, where were the parents? It's very interesting. She basically says, this is nothing new. Where were you when your kids were upstairs doing this? And you were downstairs watching the Fraser. Like, what? How does that work? Very, very intriguing argument that she makes. And a pretty nerdy one at one level. We parent here. We do live here. We're involved in this. I want to leave you guys, because I've gone on more than long enough here. But I want to leave you with the perspective of somebody who got what it was like to get involved in this stuff and to get messy. Martin Luther King. This is from the speech he made the day before he died. And I've been to the mountaintop speech. And in it, he refers to the parable of the Good Samaritan. And he says this about it. He says, and you know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking and he was acting like he'd been robbed and hurt in order to seize them, to get them over there where it'd be easier for a quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? And then because King, like I think anybody who thinks about these things and tries to engage with them any amount, realizes that's the first layer of the Mexican chili dip. He just keeps going right down to the bottom layer, and he says this. On the one hand, we're called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act. One day, we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It's not haphazard and superficial. It comes to see, true compassion comes to see, that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. If that's not a framework for engagement that gives all of us permission to engage somewhere, I don't know how to offer one. At one level, to just address ourselves as fellow humans to those that suffer,
And if that's as simple as looking the guy in the eye when he asks you for change on the street corner and saying, not today, you, human, you. If it's as simple as that, let it be as simple as that. If it's as grand as being martyred for issues of race so that profound change can happen, then let it be that. And there's a lot of room in between. The point is that we're called to look at this whole set of stories, this whole culture in which we live, with those kind of eyes, with the kind of eyes that Jesus is trying to get us to see with the kind of imagination that Jesus is trying to get us to think with when he tells this story. Don't let the conventions of not in my backyard, don't let the conventions of this does not make sense, don't let the cultural sort of byword that says, you know, you walk in there into that mess, you're going to get messy in a way that messes up your tidy life. Don't let those things shut down our imagination about what it looks like to actually love other people the way that Jesus said, if you want to see the kingdom, you got to love like this. Because that's, he goes on to say, those are the people who get to see the kingdom, who get to be a part of this thing called the kingdom. So I guess it depends if that's what we want. I know that's, again, maybe painting with too broad a line, but at some fundamental level, this is the question we have to wrestle with. Do I really want to engage with this, if that's what it means? Maybe the preacher's wrong, that's not what it means. Wouldn't that be a relief today? But maybe not. Maybe that is what it means. I think the good news, inside of a challenging idea like that, for me, is that the way that God operates with us makes room for all of those little engagements. We could walk away from a conversation like this, walk away from an event like Amanda Todd's suicide, walk away from world hunger, walk away from poverty, walk away from pick one, by going, that's just too big, there's absolutely no way to take that on. It's got nothing to do with me. I'm going to go home and be nice to my family. Not a bad idea. But when you take a whole culture and you permeate it bit by bit, relationship by relationship, conversation by conversation, you leaven it, to use the biblical picture, with an idea like, this is our deal. This is ours to engage with. This has to do, for those of us that espouse Christian faith, this has to do with who these people are because of who their maker is. How can I dignify this human in this moment? Just that. And then we start acting it out in imaginative ways. I think we're going to discover that some of those things, they do mess us up. They mess up our tidy lives. They create all sorts of conundrums for us. They bring suffering home into our space in ways that is deeply distressing. Wasn't it deeply distressing before? Well, not in the same way, was it? Not to me. It was just deeply distressing out there. Now it's deeply distressing in here. And that's going to start to produce a different way of living. And a different way of living, as the McLean's writers remind us over and over and over again, and they're wrestling with this in print, is what we need to live in a better world. It's a different conversation. We're not going to have it today. But what if the kingdom of heaven, this is, I say this out of the proportions of what Jesus said. Jesus talked an awful lot more about the kingdom of heaven now than he did anywhere else. What if we're living there? And our job is to make it. How?
Then we better take this seriously, or nobody gets to see the kingdom. And wouldn't that be something? All right. The band is starting to rehearse upstairs. That's got to be a signal. We're going to sing together. And then we're going to eat together. And if you, while you're eating, see that there's someone here that you don't know, can I suggest that it's deeply consistent with stuff we've been on about this morning to say hello? And to begin there. And then just go on.